To reflect back on the myeloma issues covered during our CME symposium, I met with faculty member Dr. Vincent Rajkumar, and to begin, we picked up on maybe the most exciting topic today in clinical oncology, also discussed by Dr. Friedberg, the use of CAR T-cell treatment.
So CAR Ts are engineered T-cells. These are engineered so that they can target specific antigens. In the case of myeloma, one of the best antigens that can be targeted is BCMA, because BCMA is expressed universally on all myeloma cells. And there are at least three different CAR Ts that are targeting BCMA, one of which was the trial that used the Bluebird Bio CAR T that Mayo Clinic participated in. And Dr. Yi Lin from Mayo Clinic provided the update to the results at EHA. The same thing was presented at ASCO as well, which indicates virtually 100% response rate. And many of these appear durable, and secondly, are not associated with major toxicities that have been reported with other CAR Ts. So this is very promising, because the patients that we enrolled had failed most other available treatments, and yet the CAR Ts were effective as single agents. There are two other studies using CAR Ts targeting BCMA that have been reported. One was reported at ASCO, that was a Chinese study, which also showed extraordinary response rates. And the other one was the University of Pennsylvania group. Adam Cohen has presented that in the past. So taken together, these studies suggest that BCMA is an excellent antigen to target, and that using a CAR T to target BCMA appears to be very effective in multiple myeloma.
So let's get back to today's therapy, and we asked a bunch of practical clinical questions during the meeting, and we reviewed with you and Dr. Rajay some of the key research databases that led to the practice pattern. And we started out with a pretty basic question, but it's always good to update on this, because general oncologists are always asked this question, which is essentially, in the age of, you know, new agents and new regimens, where does transplant sit? And we asked the audience, for a 65-year-old patient who's about to begin induction treatment, standard risk situation, how they view transplant. And we saw about half the audience said that they just recommend it. Most of the rest of them said that they recommend it, but they also are fine with just gathering cells and delaying. And I'm curious what your thoughts are on this question, and also whether or not MRD is of any value or relevance right now in answering this question.
So the first question is, where does transplant fit in? Transplant is something that, if patients are eligible for, should be always considered for multiple myeloma. In standard risk patients, I think there's sufficient data to say that overall survival is the same whether you do the transplant early or delayed. So survival is not the consideration in making that call. A lot of that depends on the patient's wishes as well as the patient's age. A patient who is close to 70 plus or would be better off with an early transplant, because otherwise they might become ineligible for one later on. But younger patients, if they wish to delay the transplant, it is reasonable. So your audience is right. Our default preferred is to the early transplant because of many reasons. It's easier, it gets approved by insurance quicker, the patient's done with the treatment, and then they can be on some low-dose maintenance. But at the same time, if for some reason they wish to delay it, that is fine as well. And they can do so with the understanding that they're going to live an equal length of time regardless of which decision they make. In the intermediate and high-risk population, however, there are other studies which suggest that early transplant may be preferable for those patients. So for those kind of patients, we generally steer them to an early transplant. Now, as far as MRD goes, the big question would be, if somebody is already MRD negative with four cycles of therapy, do you gain anything by doing an early transplant? The same question comes up after the transplant as well. If somebody's MRD negative, do we need to give maintenance? And the same question comes a year after maintenance would be, can we stop the maintenance if the MRD is negative? So those require separate randomized trials where you use MRD as an integral biomarker and decide based on the MRD result whether changing therapy is of value. And I was at the EHA meeting and the IMWG meeting last week in Madrid. There are at least six randomized trials that are planned which are looking at MRD result and then using the result to change therapy. And five of these are in Europe and one in the US. And hopefully these trials will give us that kind of answer.
So we also asked the audience about induction regimens in younger patients who are transplant eligible, both in the standard risk situation, and we also presented a case with del17p. We found that the audience is basically RVD either way. What about the selection of upfront induction therapy? Obviously, there's a big trial going on from ECOG comparing KRD with carfilzomib to VRD with bortezomib. But right now, outside a trial setting, are there situations, for example, in a high-risk patient where maybe you would favor carfilzomib?
Yes. I think the default for most newly diagnosed patients, whether they're transplant candidates or not, is the RVD or VRD regimen. It's well-tolerated. It has phase 3 data from two big phase 3 trials showing that it's very, very safe associated with, if you just did VRD transplant maintenance or VRD and maintenance, you get an 83% four-year survival rate, outstanding regimen. But in high-risk patients, we still need to do better. And the question is, without waiting for phase 3 trials, can we do something for these high-risk patients who we know have not done well even with the VRD backbone? So for example, Barlowgate, Arkansas has used VDT PACE as well as VRD PACE and then done two transplants and then give VRD maintenance for 2-3 years. And del17 patients still don't do well. We already know that. So is it fair to tell them to keep doing that? Or should we say something is really promising, it seems to have a higher MRD rate, maybe more toxicity, maybe more expensive, but can we try that for the select subset of patients? And the Mayo Clinic group at least feels that we should do that. And so young patients, less than 65, who are transplant eligible, who are high risk, we favor carfilzomib Lendex in that population based on that justification. The ECOG trial will tell you the answer eventually. Now, another approach would be to add a fourth drug. Maybe we add an antibody along with VRD or KRD to that high-risk population at this point. That hasn't happened yet, but that's being studied by the SWOG group in randomized phase 2 trials. So KRD plus minus daratumumab is the SWOG trial design. But that kind of tells you where our thinking process is.
I was just thinking about an interview I did yesterday with Anne Lacasse, and we were talking about CLL and 17P and how, you know, effective ibrutinib and venetoclax is, and chemotherapy is not effective at all. What do we know about daratumumab and elotuzumab?
Well, both of them seem to be active in high-risk populations. And so in the relapse trials, Castor, Pollux, and Eloquent studies, they both have done well in the high-risk populations. And that's why both these drugs are being tested in the high-risk settings in newly diagnosed patients. So the first SWOG trial that was done was VRD plus minus elotuzumab. The successor is KRD plus minus daratumumab, also by the SWOG group. So we are thinking that high-risk myeloma patients should be approached differently, probably with a quadruplet, which includes a monoclonal antibody, either dara or elo.
What's the thinking, a projection in terms of when those trials might read out?
They both randomized phase 2, so they will read out quicker, and they're smaller trials. They are benchmarked to what we expect for a PFS and overall survival for a patient in the old days, so it's not a randomized comparison against each other arm-wise.
So let's talk about induction. We talked about induction in the younger transplant-eligible patient, and we can talk about the older patient. We posed a 78-year-old patient to the audience. And as you alluded to, the vast majority used RVD or RVD light. Can you talk about, for practical purposes, how you approach using RVD or RVD light in the elderly patient?
Well, sure. I think in the elderly patient, particularly those over 75, if one is going to use a triplet with RVD light or something like that, the dexamethasone dose is more like 20 milligrams once a week. The lenalidomide dose is reduced to maybe 15 milligrams, and the bortezomib is given once a week subcutaneously. Oftentimes, once the initial response has occurred, rather than giving bortezomib every week, I might do 2 weeks on, 1 week off. That gives patients a break. That's one approach. The other approach is to simply give them RD alone at full dose and see how well they do. Again, dex at 20. And the third approach is ixazomib. It makes it quite easy for elderly patients to take ixazomib frontline. Ixazomib Lendex versus Lendex frontline trial should read out in the next year. It's already done. It's awaiting analysis. And so we will have more data on that. But that's a completely oral regimen, and patients can take it at home and not have to travel frequently for IV.
And it also brings up the issue of how much data do you need to use exazimib as opposed to, for example, bortezomib. Obviously, we can't study every situation. I mean, when are you willing to switch? I mean, for example, if you're using upfront treatment, maybe the patient has trouble getting to clinic. I mean, are you okay with bringing in exazimib?
Yes, I think right now the main instances where we are using it are patients where they really love the fact that they can stay a month away from seeing the doctor. And it's not that easy, you know, coming to Minnesota in the winter to get a weekly shot of bortezomib. It's not a 5-minute thing. They're going to spend 2-3 hours. So it is a consideration for that purpose. Now, the problem, Neil, is going to be cost in terms of, like, eventually when bortezomib becomes generic in the U.S. and it's much less expensive than ixazomib or carfilzomib, then the real drama will start in terms of who pays what, who gets what. We will see. But I think ixazomib, you're right, we don't need to test every setting. It's roughly equivalent to bortezomib. And we will see, based on the readout of the frontline trial, you know, how well it does as a replacement for VRD.
As long as we're talking about exazimib, I'm curious with your experience with the agent, particularly in terms of tolerability. I know there are situations where you see GI toxicity. What have you observed?
Yes, GI toxicity has been a problem, but not at the usual doses we use. Initial studies, we were trying to get up the dose to more than 5 milligrams, 5.5 milligrams, and it was a problem. But with the 4 milligram dose, yes, there is some GI side effects, but bortezomib also has some GI side effects. So we trade off neuropathy for some extra GI side effects for sure, but it's okay. We can adjust the dosing and particularly lower the dose of 3 milligrams or something and manage the side effects.
What do we know right now about neuropathy comparing exazimib to carfilzomib to bortezomib? And for example, again, elderly patient, maybe longstanding diabetes, they already have a pre-existing neuropathy. What would you be thinking?
So, you know, if we were talking standard dose of bortezomib twice a week or intravenous dosing, the neuropathy is going to be substantially higher with bortezomib compared to either of the other two drugs. Once weekly sub-Q bortezomib is actually quite good. And so now you're talking the neuropathy risk only in a small minority of patients that one would have to think, you know, because of neuropathy, I'm going to switch to ixazomib or carfilzomib. I would say both ixazomib and carfilzomib have lower risk of neuropathy than bortezomib, probably even lower than bortezomib sub-Q once a week. So they're certainly great options for patients who are suffering from neuropathy.
So one more question in terms of tolerability. I always like to get an update on where people see things in terms of carfilzomib. Ever since the drug came out, there's been the question of, you know, cardiac effects, the question of the sort of a dyspnea syndrome that you see in some patients. At this point, how do you view that?
Well, you know, I view it more like an idiosyncratic reaction. Carfilzomib is actually quite well tolerated for the vast majority of patients. It's the 5% of patients or 5 to 7% of patients who have a significant cardiac type event, which is either like pulmonary edema or like shortness of breath or what looks like heart failure. And these are patients who don't have a permanent damage, but for that particular time point, it's quite frightening. The other thing to note about carfilzomib is that the Clarion trial, which was done in elderly patients, has a slight signal, potentially slightly higher mortality in the carfilzomib arm. It's not statistically significant, but it's there. So those two things make me nervous. But balanced out are the fact that it is probably a better proteasome inhibitor. It has a better progression-free survival than bortezomib does if you do head-to-head. And so for the vast majority of patients, particularly if they're younger, I have absolutely no worries about giving carfilzomib. It's well tolerated in the sense that you don't get neuropathy, you don't get any of the conventional chemo type side effects. The main concern for me with carfilzomib has always been cost relative to a generic version of bortezomib if it comes out and how that might play out.
I was mentioning that I interviewed your colleague, Dr. Kumar, yesterday, and I was telling him about a case where the patient just said in retrospect, you know, every time I got the carfilzomib, I'd feel a little short of breath that day. So how often does a patient say that to you, and what do you do if they do say it to you?
Well, I think just having a little bit of shortness of breath is more common. Probably, I would say 20% of patients would do it. But again, sometimes we are, without a control group, sometimes we start asking leading questions and get certain answers. I would go to the Aspire trial, which had a head-to-head comparison of carfilzomib, Lendex, and Lendex, and you would see that there is a virtually similar adverse effect profile between the two for many, many of these side effects.
Do you get an echo before you start carfilzomib, and would you get an echo on a patient who told you that they felt a little short of breath?
Oh, great question. I am not routinely doing echocardiograms if the patients look good generally for carfilzomib. There have been many studies which have done echocardiograms systematically, and what they all show is that there's no sustained loss of ejection fraction or any cardiac problems with carfilzomib. It's a transient effect. It's idiosyncratic in a small percent of patients, and the vast majority, you don't have any reduction in cardiac function.
So let's talk a little bit about maintenance therapy. And we presented a scenario of a patient, 65-year-old, but with high-risk disease, DEL17P, who gets RVD transplant and has a CR. And we asked the audience what they would do about maintenance in this high-risk situation. And actually, the most common answer was just lenalidomide. However, both you and Dr. Rajay, who are the two faculty, would include a proteasome inhibitor. Actually, she would use len and ix, interestingly, and you were more inclined, at least when we asked in the meeting, to use bortezomib without lenalidomide. Can you talk a little bit about your approach to maintenance in the normal risk situation, the high risk situation? Does it change with having a CR? Does it change, as you were bringing up before, if the patient's MRD negative?
Yeah, I'll give you two answers. One is on the maintenance topic. I mean, I'm guided by the data. The data are that if you look at the meta-analysis of all of the trials that look at post-transplant maintenance with lenalidomide, there is a survival benefit and a progression-free survival benefit with the use of len maintenance. Then you look at, are there patients who absolutely did not benefit at all? And those are the high-risk patients. There, the hazard ratio was right at one or even slightly worse. So len had no effect in that population. Using that piece of information and another piece of information that comes from the HOVON trial, where they found that when you use bortezomib maintenance, one dose every 2 weeks, the overall survival of deletion 17 patients was almost as good as patients who did not have deletion 17P. I prefer bortezomib every other week or some fashion of bortezomib-based maintenance for patients who have intermediate and high-risk disease, and reserve lenalidomide for the remaining 75% of patients who have standard-risk disease. Where I differ from Dr. Rajay is I don't add lenalidomide necessarily to the high-risk patients because I don't see an effect yet of len maintenance in prolonging survival that I could add on with bortezomib. So I think it will just add more toxicity. So that's my approach. I know Sagar, Lonial, and Newport think VRD would be a good approach. I don't have a problem with that. It's just that I don't have compelling data to support that.
So the first thing I thought about, the first time I heard about oral proteasome inhibitors, including ixazomib, also there's aprozomib that kind of seems similar to carfilzomib, I was thinking about the maintenance situation. And I'm curious, again, how easy it would be for you to substitute ixazomib for bortezomib in this maintenance situation. Well, how long do you use bortezomib? I'm assuming it's not indefinite, but would you consider indefinite ixazomib if the patient was tolerating it well?
Actually, bortezomib, the trial was up to 3 years, and I would be willing to go even longer as long as the patient's doing well. And ixazomib, same thing. Ixazomib also, there is a phase 3 trial of ixazomib versus placebo post-transplant maintenance that has been completed. Accrual's done, waiting for analysis. So we will have the results shortly. And these are newer trials, so they will have results from how did each cytogenetic group perform. And we'd be looking very closely at the high-risk group in that trial to see if ixazomib had the same effect that bortezomib had. I don't have any reason to doubt on that question. So I think, again, if a patient has a problem with taking bortezomib maintenance and they're high risk, I'm comfortable giving them ixazomib maintenance based on what we know already about that drug.
Any concerns about long-term use of exazimib? You would think it sounds like it would be a pretty smooth situation.
I have, again, no reservations about using it. I don't have any major concerns. It's very similar to bortezomib. You know, that's where I'm coming from. Chemically, it's similar. Works by the same mechanism. It's a boronic acid derivative. I don't have a reason to believe it cannot. Initially, when we use bortezomib, we would give it for 8 cycles and stop, and then people realize you can keep going. I have a patient who is nearly 10 years plus on bortezomib, continuously, and she's a spokesman for the drug now. These are drugs, if you space them out correctly, can be given for a very long time.
So let's talk about a few of the relapse scenarios. And I just want to ask you, you know, I happened to see a slide set that Dr. Kumar had, and I actually reviewed it with him. And I don't know whether you use the same approach, but I had never seen this before. Usually you talk about relapse myeloma, and it's just like all over the place. But he had a way of looking at it based on whether the relapse occurred in a patient who was on a proteasome inhibitor and resistant, on a IMiD and resistant, on both, on neither. It was just kind of a simple approach, but it really, to me, I felt it really organized things a little bit better. Is that conceptually the way you look at relapse disease?
Yes, certainly. And in fact, we have on msmart.org an approach which is based on first relapse, and then it looks at what is the patient relapsing on. Is it on lenalidomide or proteasome inhibitor? And then second and subsequent relapses where you go to dual refractory patients, triple refractory patients, quadruple refractory patients, penta-refractory patient, and then look at what the options are. That way, at least you get an idea. What I feel is that there are no head-to-head trials of these really good triplets that we have for first relapse. And so we are forced to make decisions based on non-randomized comparisons across the various trials. So for patients who are IMiD-sensitive, who are not refractory to lenalidomide, say they're relapsing on nothing or small doses of lenalidomide, then I would be more in favor of using daratumumab Lendex or carfilzomib Lendex as my default option. Whereas if the patient is refractory to lenalidomide, then you would go with a bortezomib-containing regimen such as daratumumab bortezomib Dex. Sometimes you also have patients who are relapsing on lenalidomide that you can use a pomalidomide-based regimen instead.
So let's go through with that infrastructure, that sort of algorithm, a few of the cases that we actually presented. One was a 65-year-old patient, gets RVD, transplant, and then 18 months later relapses while receiving Len maintenance. And we saw that the audience was kind of split between Dara and a proteasome inhibitor and carfilzomib, POM, and Dex. How would you think through this situation? Another option that might be considered in this situation could be daratumumab and an IMiD, and also the idea of elotuzumab and lenalidomide, increasing the dose of the lenalidomide up to the therapeutic level. How do you sort through those options?
The patient that you presented is the most classic one. So currently, the standard of care for most patients would be RVD, transplant, Len maintenance. And then 4 years later, they're going to be relapsing. In this case, 18 months after the transplant. When they are relapsing, they're relapsing on small doses of lenalidomide, only like 10 milligrams. So I'm very comfortable in those patients with continuing with the lenalidomide-based regimen and reserving all the other options for later on. And so typically what I have recommended is Dara-Lendex. It's based on the Pollux trial. It has the best hazard ratio. And you just increase the dose of lenalidomide to 25 and add daratumumab and dexamethasone, and you follow that approach. It's the same approach you would do if the patient was relapsing off of all maintenance. I know people will get nervous that they're increasing the dose of lenalidomide and adding only one new drug. And if that's the concern, then certainly switching to pomalidomide instead of lenalidomide would also be reasonable. I don't consider these patients who are relapsing on small doses of lenalidomide as len refractory or IMiD refractory. That's the bottom line. Because we don't want to abandon IMiDs, which can give the patient quite a bit more of progression-free survival time and allow you to save all of the other options for later. Now, whether you use Dara or Elo, it's really, there are no trials to judge us by. Elo does seem a little bit more easier to tolerate and faster to infuse. And therefore, if the patient's elderly and frail, one might be tempted to use elotuzumab first instead of Dara.
What do you yourself in your own practice do in terms of duration of len maintenance?
The duration of len maintenance really, you know, Neil, right now depends on the patient. We usually give for at least a year or two. At that point, it's the main factors why we decide to stop are patient-initiated. It's due to three things: fatigue, diarrhea, or leg cramps. They do get that. And sometimes they say, can you give me a break? And you give them a break for 1 or 2 months, and they come back to you and say, oh, it is like a load has been lifted off my shoulders. I'm feeling so much better now. Can we just try for some more time without the maintenance? So oftentimes, a side effect or patient factor that prompts discontinuation. I'm really hoping to see what the quality of life difference would be between the 2 years versus indefinite in Dr. Kumar's study.
You were talking about the diarrhea. I think I'm trying to remember the agent, the bile salt agent. I've heard that that's very effective with the diarrhea lenalidomide.
It is. I have used it on patients, and I've recommended it to patients. The study came from the Arkansas group. They thought that the diarrhea was due to bile acid malabsorption that was induced by lenalidomide, and that if you give a bile acid sequestrant, like cholestipol, that you would be able to stop the diarrhea. And I've tried to give it to patients, and it generally works. And they're able to titrate it, because the diarrhea usually is important to them only when they're traveling, because it's once a day or twice a day. They're okay with not taking anything for most days that they're going to be at home. But if they're traveling or something, they say they take the bile acid sequestrant. It helps them. Some patients take it routinely and it helps them.
Interesting. So we also presented a patient who, same thing, 65-year-old, RVD transplant, but gets len maintenance for 2 years and then it stopped. And then the patient relapsed 18 months later. And we saw a whole variety of answers in the audience, Carpom-Dex, Dara, and an IMID. How do you approach the, I guess this would fit into your category of potentially sensitive to both.
Yes, potentially sensitive to both. I default to the lenalidomide because it's oral. And also, you know, we have a lot of data on that stuff. If you look at the absolute progression-free survival that was seen in the Castor versus Pollux, Pollux, of course, has much longer PFS durations, maybe because the sample, the type of patient studied were different. So I default to the Pollux if the patient is, in my opinion, len sensitive. And I usually put an asterisk. What do I mean by len sensitive? Patients who are relapsing off all therapy, patients who are relapsing on small doses of len, then I'm okay with trying a len-based regimen. Just to make sure that we use len to its full potential before turning to other drugs.
So the last thing I want to ask you about, speaking of new agents, because this one sort of came out of the blue, which is venetoclax. And of course, it's approved in CLL, but now we're really seeing some exciting and I think really interesting from a biologic point of view findings with myeloma. What do we know about venetoclax?
Venetoclax is, in the studies that we have done, has like a 50% response rate in 11-14 patients. These are patients who have the cyclin D overexpression, and these patients have responded extremely well to venetoclax. And in the other patients who don't have 11-14, the response rate's more like 5% or so. I think this drug is going to be very effective. It's the same kind of result you see in mantle cell lymphoma. So for this population or populations which have cyclin D overexpression in myeloma, it's going to have a good place.
What about assays for BCL2 activity? Have they been looked at to try to predict benefit, including in the non-11-14 patients?
I am not sure. I don't know. In myeloma, I do not know.
Well, actually, Saji was telling me about that, and I was like, I never heard that before. Some kind of assay for BCL2. Makes sense, though, right?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, but he was saying that you see some of these non-11-14 patients who have it, but I don't remember whether you said that they've actually tried venetoclax. I think he said they did.
No, we do. We treat all patients. The response rate is 50% in the 11-14s and about 5% or so. So who are these 5%? We don't want to lose them.
I guess the other thing about that, and you mentioned mantle cell, it sounds like there's pretty good activity, but one of the things that's interesting is, and maybe this is a reflection of BCL2 levels in CLL compared to those disease, that it seems like you're not really seeing tumor lysis with myeloma or mantle cell like you see with CLL.
No, not myeloma generally doesn't have tumor lysis and not seen with venetoclax either.
Are there any clinical situations like plasma cell leukemia, for example, where you would, you know, be concerned about TLS?
Oh, definitely. In plasma cell leukemia, there's already, I mean, I haven't come across the right patient to use it. Plasma cell leukemia, some patients, in fact, quite a few patients are 11-14 positive. And they have a dismal prognosis. And so it's a situation where we will definitely want to try venetoclax. It's been brought up in discussions. I haven't done it personally, but if I were to do it, oh my, definitely we'll have to prophylax and be very watchful for tumor lysis.